Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia. The idea behind Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise research. So exercise physiology, exercise metabolism, and exercise and health. And what I'm really wanting is for you to get your information from the research experts on exercise rather than from influencers. And indeed, today I'm bringing to you two experts, so a double header for the first time. So I've got Dr. Nicola Guess from Oxford University in England, and Professor Jonathan Little, who's coming on for the second time from the University of British Columbia in Canada. Nicola is a dietitian and researcher with a lot of expertise around these glucose spikes, the use of glucose monitors, so continuous glucose monitors, etc. While Jonathan is an exercise researcher who does research with diet as well. You will see that Jonathan was on the podcast previously talking about keto diets, so you might want to have a look at that as well. We've all heard about these so-called glucose spikes or glucose excursions, and a lot of sort of hype in the media and with influencers, et cetera, talking about how you don't want to have glucose spikes. You don't want your glucose to rise and it's damaging, et cetera. A very important point that came out during the discussion is the difference between having chronically elevated glucose, which tends to happen in people with diabetes, and having a spike or an excursion in glucose after a meal. To have an increase in glucose after a meal is normal physiology. Glucose goes up, insulin is released from the pancreas, your glucose comes down again, that's normal physiology. Having elevated glucose, as in diabetes, is damaging to your body and is something to try and counter. So we talked about, you know, what causes increases in glucose after a meal. Are they important in someone with type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, if you have normal glucose tolerance? Also, we talked about how glucose can increase after very intense exercise and how that is also normal physiology. Talked a lot about how glucose may just be a symptom, not a cause of a problem. People don't die from an elevated glucose level per se. It's generally, if you're a person with diabetes, it's more the high blood pressure, the high blood cholesterol, etc., which is damaging to you and not your glucose spikes. So we talked a lot about that. We talked about the pros and cons of using continuous glucose monitors. Should everyone be using continuous glucose monitors or not? And there's definitely a lot of pros and cons to consider. I found it very interesting. I think you will too. So stick around. You'll get the most out of the podcast, of course, if you watch the whole thing to get the full context, but you can look down in the notes and see that there are timestamps. So you can see, for example, on YouTube in blue, you can see the time. If you click on that, it'll move to that particular section. And on the other platforms, you can see the time, but you just can't click on them. So if you wanted to jump around, you could do that. If you'd like to help me out and also get the message out more about Inside Exercise, it would be great if you could like, subscribe, leave comments, etc., because then the algorithm tends to suggest Inside Exercise more when people do searches. Okay, so enjoy the chat. Okay, hi. This is the first time we've done a double header. So we've got Nicola Guess and Jonathan Little. Welcome to Inside Exercise.
Thank you for having us.
Great. It's great to be back and be here, Glenn.
Yes, so Jonathan the second time, which is great. Thanks for coming on. All right, so and we may even talk about, they will probably come up here and there. So we talked with Jonathan about ketones and exercise and diet, etc. But today we're going to be talking about these glucose spikes. So glucose excursions. So is it a bad thing? Do we need to worry, you know, if you have a meal and your glucose goes up, do we need to stop that at all costs? Or is that normal physiology? Does it matter if you're a person with diabetes or not, if you're overweight or not, all these sorts of things. And what about with exercise? So we'll get to this later on, but during very high intensity exercise, your glucose levels can actually increase. Is that a bad thing? Do we need to worry about that? And what if you're a person with type 1 diabetes, for example? So what we thought we'd do is we might just start off sort of talking about what are these glucose spikes, glucose excursions anyway? What are people even talking about? And then get into those sort of details. So maybe if we start off with Nicola, do you want to just explain what are glucose spikes? I mean, you know, and is that even a good term for it? And you know, what's everyone going on about?
So there's no definition of what a glucose spike is or a glucose excursion. I think it's generally understood to be the kind of acute transient rise you get in glucose, say after a meal or after a carbohydrate load. So it's just the really obvious going up and coming back down again after a meal or a drink. And I think it's really critical to contrast that with the hyperglycemia of diabetes or even pre-diabetes. And I think that's something that gets missed, which is wild to me that it does. But just to absolutely clarify, people have started to really care about, oh my God, glucose, of course, because of diabetes. No one wants to get diabetes. People, you know, get worried about it quite rightly. But diabetes is where your glucose is elevated all the time, pretty much. So it's elevated during the night when you're fasting, maybe for 8 to 12 hours. And because it's already high in the morning, when you have breakfast, it's going to go even higher. So you're spending 24 hours a day with hyperglycemia. Same with pre-diabetes. It's slightly lower, but effectively your glucose is higher than it should be pretty much all the time. And that really, we have to differentiate between diabetes, pre-diabetes, and oh, my glucose is normal most of the time, but oh my goodness, it's gone up after I eat. But that's what we're talking about, I think, when we talk about glucose spikes.
Exactly. And it kind of makes sense. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is, again, that spins me out that people don't sort of get that, you know, people can imagine if your glucose is like elevated the whole time, it could be doing damage, and we know it does do damage, versus you just have a meal, glucose is absorbed into the blood, your glucose goes up, and then you've got responses by the body. You know, the body releases insulin from the pancreas that stimulates the tissues to take up the glucose, it comes down again. You know, that's just normal physiology. And I guess one thing, if we add on to that, is what about, so the person that has type 2 diabetes, for example, and their glucose is elevated, as you say, a lot of the time, what about when they have a meal? Is that spike? Because maybe people are getting confused about that, because okay, we know people with diabetes, they've got to be careful of their glucose levels. Can we kind of tie that together a little bit, maybe?
Yeah, I think that's where there is some evidence. So there is some evidence that postprandial glucose, when people have type 2 diabetes, that glucose can not only go up, obviously much higher than in people without diabetes, but it will stay elevated for much longer. And I think there's quite a bit of evidence that these prolonged and very high glucose excursions in type 2 diabetes, let's call them spikes, do in fact contribute to disease. So it makes sense to me, and I think for most clinicians, that we do care about glucose spikes in diabetes.
Yep. Actually, Jonathan, did you want to just explain a little bit about what sort of damage does chronically elevated glucose do to the body, you know, just generally? And then if you did the spike, and then if people that they are chronically elevated glucose have a meal and it goes up, you know, potentially why is that sort of damaging and concerning? Sure.
And without getting into all the molecular mechanisms, but, you know, chronic hyperglycemia or elevated glycemia, why is that bad? It's linked with the development of advanced glycation end products, or AGEs. So those are just sugar molecules sticking to other molecules, you know, in your cells. And the idea there is if you have a protein that functions normally without sugar stuck to it, and now you stick a glucose molecule to it, it's probably not going to work as well as it you should or used to, as well as it might cause an inflammatory response, and you know that. And then the other one from chronic hyperglycemia is reactive oxygen species or oxidative stress, and whether that is coming from mitochondria or other enzymes that generate reactive oxygen species, I think you can make arguments for a little bit of both. But that's the kind of big picture. Why is high blood sugar bad? It's because of AGEs and reactive oxygen species. There is some evidence, as Nicholas suggested, there much stronger in type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance, that during a big excursion into hyperglycemia, there's exacerbated ROS and inflammatory responses, particularly in your blood vessels. So in the cells lining your blood vessels and in your immune cells that are floating around in your blood exposed to this, they may have accelerated oxidative stress and inflammation during that big excursion. And the thought is that causes kind of like an insult or damage, and then you come back down. And then, so if this is happening repeatedly on the background of hyperglycemia, that's when the problem is. And just one other clarification with that spikes, I'm sure we'll get to it later on with the CGM. It's not only the magnitude, it's the duration, as Nicholas said. In type 2 diabetes, when you consume a high carbohydrate load, that glucose spike lasts for 3-4 hours and usually never comes back down to normal before you have your next meal, versus someone with normal glycemia, good blood sugar control, their glucose goes up, and within 1 or 2 hours, it's back down to normal. And that's probably normal physiology, that your blood sugar goes up and down within a 1 to 2 hour window.
Can I just jump in there and maybe add a few details on clinical consequences and the glucose level at which those occur? So that's a really nice explanation, John. And I think translating it to, like, what does it mean for people? The first thing that we have, you know, we're pretty confident about is the relationship between hyperglycemia and neuropathy, so retinopathy, and basically kind of blood vessels being damaged. We are pretty confident that happens at the level where your fasting glucose is about 7. So that's 126 milligram per deciliter. So 7 millimole per liter, 126 milligram per deciliter. And here's the really, really important thing. It's not that that 7 is some kind of threshold that can't be crossed, like, oh my God, you get to 7, boom, we get damage. It's that when investigators went back to look at these large data sets, what they found is that if people had a fasting glucose of 7 millimole per liter, they nearly always had a 2 hour glucose of 11.1. That's 200 milligram per deciliter. And it's probably that. It's this, because if at 2 hours after a glucose tolerance test, your glucose is 11.1 millimole per liter, 200 milligram per deciliter, guess what? It was probably at 15 millimole per liter before. And it's going to stay, like John said, elevated for 3-4 hours. That's what's causing retinopathy. We have as certain as we can be in science, that's the level at which that happens. I would say that with cardiovascular disease, it's a bit more uncertain. So that's the other thing that those processes that John talked about can cause. And that's macrovascular disease. So things like basically strokes and heart attacks. Because at the end of the day, despite, you know, the retinopathy, which can really impede quality of life, what kills people, sadly, is strokes and heart attacks. And it looks like that damage happens a lot lower than the cutoffs I gave for retinopathy. And we can talk a bit more about that.
Right. Okay. So just to make sure people are clear that, so with the microvascular, we're talking about micro, I mean, you know, small. So the little blood vessels, so as you said, affecting your retina, your kidney, et cetera, your blood flow. And then the macro is the bigger vessels. So your coronary heart disease. Yeah. And you were saying that 7.1, which is 126 in the US language, is people get caught up on that, as you said, and then they think, oh, I can't go above that. So if I have a meal, it goes above that. But you're saying it's very different, because the fact is that the people that have the slightly elevated, well, the elevated glucose, they are then going to get more elevated after a meal. And that's that big kind of pressure on the...
Exactly. And it comes back to, you know, pragmatism in terms of who do we screen? I mean, ultimately, this is why you want to get these numbers right. Mm-hmm. So people are going to their primary care. If you do a glucose tolerance test, it's a fantastic test, but it can take 2 hours. People have got to fast. It's labor intensive, mm-hmm. So it costs healthcare systems more. The great thing about identifying this relationship between the fasting glucose and the 2 hour glucose is that you only needed to do a fasting glucose to be able to say with a decent amount of confidence, right, these are the people we need to pay attention to. Let's get them the right care so we can lower their glucose and improve their overall health.
Glad you brought that up.
Just to hammer that home for those mm-hmm. values, those cutoffs don't mean if your glucose goes above this, you get damage and will have mm-hmm. that. They mean in an observational study, those were the thresholds where we saw, you know, clear, distinct increases in risk of retinopathy, et cetera. So that makes sense. So to make it's a kind of like that pseudoscience, right? Like, you know, a little bit, that's the cutoff mm-hmm. for retinopathy. Therefore, I can't go above
can't
that.
Go
that's
above
not
that.
What studies show, right?
So, yeah, John, to emphasize, just to really make this clear, thank you, John, for saying that. Because what I hear is people saying, oh, I got diabetic or pre-diabetic levels of glucose. And people say, oh, I've got pre-diabetic levels of glucose because my glucose went above 7.8 millimoles per liter. Oh. After I ate. But that's the cutoff for pre-diabetes when you're looking at the concentration of glucose 2 hours after a glucose drink. So again, like we've been emphasizing, if your glucose is still that high 2 hours after you ate something, guess what? It's high all the time. So I think, John,
all right.
we've emphasized that just a one-off glucose measure has no relationship to these very standardized cutoffs, which are looking 2 hours after you have a glucose drink.
Great. Right. Well, I think this is great that we've emphasized it. I want to emphasize it even more.
Sorry. Cool.
That, okay, yeah. Okay. So you're saying, as you're saying, people worry, oh, 7.1 is the cutoff, which is 126. Yeah. In, yeah.
And, yeah. So it's 7 millimole per liter or 126 milligram per deciliter.
Correct. I'm so used to millimoles per liter. Anyway, so as you say, oh, they measure it. Oh, I'm above that. That's a bad thing. But you're saying if you're above that after 2 hours after, you know, an oral glucose tolerance test, which is taking 75 grams of glucose, and then it goes up and it comes down. Or, you know, it's so different to being elevated the whole time. Going up and then down is totally normal. Okay, so we've talked about people with type 2 diabetes. What about people with type 1 diabetes? What do we have to think about with them? Hopefully we've made it clear enough that you know, people that are normal, healthy as far as we know, they don't have any insulin resistance, any glucose intolerance, they don't really have to worry that much about their glucose levels.
Mm-hmm. So I would just add a couple of clarifications there. About 60% of the population have insulin resistance, and that's probably has negative consequences. That is related to cardiovascular disease. But what keeps their glucose at normal levels is that their beta cells can compensate, we think, for the insulin resistance. So it's not to say that you don't need to worry about potentially your glucose creeping up in the future if you have insulin resistance, but I think it's more about, does elevated glucose cause some of these things to happen? So, for example, I hear people saying, oh, glucose peaks contribute to the development of type 2 diabetes, whereas I think they have it the wrong way around, because it's probably far more likely people have this underlying pathophysiology. They have insulin resistance, their beta cells stop working properly. That's when glucose starts creeping up. And you might see gradual increases in these glucose excursions that don't get to pre-diabetes yet, but it doesn't mean there's nothing going on there.
Yeah. Is it too simple to summarize that it's not the peaks generally, it's the baseline that you're going to more worry about. So if you're kind of running high and then you have a meal, sure, the peak might be greater, but it's not like, oh, I've got a high peak, therefore I've got a problem. It's like, well, why do you have a high peak? And you've got a problem with your baseline physiology, is it?
This is a really interesting point, because again, it comes to cause and effect. Lots of people will look and say, oh my goodness, you've got a really high glucose spike. Now, if that glucose spike came as a, you know, let's put a number on it. Let's say it is 12 millimole per litre, which I'm making this up, but this is probably around 210, 220 milligram per litre, right? So we're getting that high. That's probably higher than you'd want it to be. Maybe that's an indication something's going on. If you had that as a result of having like 50 grams of carbohydrate, not much, that's probably a sign either you've got some insulin resistance, and also probably your beta cells are beginning to dysfunction. So the glucose spike you see, whether or not we need to be concerned about it, probably depends on knowing what's going on underneath and not just the glucose spike per se. Because, for example, I've got no family history of type 2. I'm a long distance runner. I exercise a ton. Once I was wearing a CGM for a project we were doing. I had an entire pizza at like 2 a.m., right, middle of the night, worst thing in the world. And I think my glucose got to 11.1. So no, higher than that. I think it was like 11.5 millimole per liter. So pretty high. Yeah. And I wasn't remotely concerned. And we don't have enough information to know right now what's a concerning glucose spike. I wasn't concerned because I'm like, I know I don't have any risk factors. But like I said, if someone is getting glucose creeping up higher than you would possibly want after a very small amount of carb, it shows that something's going wrong underneath.
Yep. Jonathan, maybe if you could chime in here. What I wanted to do is also talk about, because, you know, Nicola, you talked about, you know, you go and get your measures done, you fasted, you have an oral glucose tolerance test. As we know, that isn't usually what happens. People will go to the doctor might say, well, come in fasted and we'll measure. So why don't you just talk about how, if you just do fasting glucose or fasting glucose and insulin, that's not giving us the whole picture. Did you want to just explain that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. And just, again, I think it's related to what I was going to make a comment there. But so if you go in to get your fasting metabolic health measures, right? The easiest, if we're talking glucose control, that you'd measure your fasting blood glucose. And as Nicola mentioned there, figuring out what's going on under the hood, you need to know a little bit more than just glucose. And usually we would then measure insulin. So fasting glucose and fasting insulin, you put those together, and I explain this to my students in class. We just had our exam. That tells you how good is your liver at regulating your blood sugars, right? Because your liver is constantly leaking out blood glucose to maintain your blood sugar levels. So if your liver is too leaky, then fasting blood glucose tends to rise up. What would happen there? Your beta cells would produce insulin to try to keep it in check. So that the balance of that, if it's costing you a lot of insulin to keep your blood sugars in check, then your HOMA score, you essentially multiply the fasting glucose and fasting insulin together, it would go up. If your blood sugar is high and your insulin high, then your HOMA score is even higher. So that's telling you what's going on under the hood. And as Nicola said in the beginning, we think that what would happen is the beta cells for both of you would produce extra insulin and keep the blood sugar in check. So that's why some people think, oh, we need to measure, or it'd be better to measure both glucose and insulin. Fasting is not the whole story, because as we just mentioned, it's pretty much just telling you what the liver is doing. So that's why you want to, if you want a full picture, you want to challenge the system with a glucose load or a carbohydrate load. And then you get a more dynamic measure that tells you how good are your beta cells at producing insulin when they need to, and how good is that insulin work primarily on your muscles, but other tissues involved, are to clear that glucose out. And just to, so then to put that together with the context of glucose spikes and the baseline, it's the integration of your baseline chronic hypoglycemia with the magnitude and the duration of the spike, which is probably linked to your health. And again, these things are interdependent. So they're evidence of underlying insulin resistance and beta cell dysfunction. You have high spikes and they stay up for a long period of time. So figuring out which one came first or which is the, culprit. If you consume carbohydrates and your blood glucose spikes up and comes back down to normal, I think it's evidence that everything is working as it should, but there's context. So as Nicholas said, if you have a small amount of carbohydrates and it goes up for a long period of time, very high, clearly that would be a case. And I'm sure we'll get to this, where a continuous glucose monitor might unmask something that you wouldn't otherwise know. But I don't think that everybody needs to be running around keeping their glucose in a flat line all day long by never allowing glucose to go up.
Exactly. And that's almost where the point's got to now. People are getting, well, we'll talk about the pros and cons of continuous glucose monitors in a bit, but saying you need to get a glucose monitor and make sure you're not getting any of these spikes. You want to be almost like a flat line. And I think we're making it kind of clear that's just not normal physiology. Now, the good thing you touched on there is, and I'm glad you did, is that the fasting levels of your glucose are more related to your liver. And as you say, when we're talking about insulin resistance and things like that, when you have a meal and your glucose goes up, what determines it coming down again is largely, not entirely, your muscle. Your muscle is the major site of glucose uptake. So we're talking about very different things. Now, what I want to touch on as well is how initially, so if you are insulin, so just to clarify as well, if you're insulin resistant, as it sounds like, your body's kind of not responding properly to insulin. It's a bit resistant to it. So if anything, you need to release more insulin to get the same response. So you have a meal, your glucose goes up, and then it comes down. And then if you're becoming insulin resistant, so for example, you might be overweight, inactive, et cetera, then you need more insulin to get that same response. Okay, now what I wanted to bring in, so that's the insulin resistance. You need more insulin to get the same response. And then as Nicola touched on, that's assuming your beta cells from the pancreas are doing their job, releasing insulin. But, later on, you can have problems with your insulin secretion as well. What I wanted to touch on is this concept that if you just measure the glucose, so if you did an oral glucose tolerance test, so you go and fasted, you drink 75 grams of glucose, you follow your glucose over 2 hours, usually sometimes 3 hours, you may actually get a situation where the glucose may look normal, right?
Yeah.
And then why don't you just touch on that, Nicola, that it's when you measure the insulin, you might see something going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really just reiterating the point that John made. Glucose alone in isolation doesn't tell you that much because, like you said, glucose could go up and it comes down really quickly, but that you wouldn't be able to tell whether your beta cells are having to work into in overdrive to bring that glucose down again. So for that reason, glucose is not on its own, in my view, a useful measure. And I think the other thing to also make really clear is elevated glucose is the consequence. It's a symptom of stuff that's going wrong underneath. And I think maybe we'll touch on this later on. This is so important when we think about, well, what do we need to do to prevent cardiovascular disease? What do we need to do to prevent type 2 diabetes? Because if you have this idea in your head, oh, the glucose spikes, the
Are the
elevated glucose
problem.
is causing things, then
Perfect.
the behavior you engage in to address those could be good or bad. So just to give you an example, because we're going to move on to exercise, you know, one of the things that people do to control their glucose, they might go, oh, I'm going to exercise because exercise is going to bring down my glucose. That would be a great thing to do for prevention of type 2 diabetes. Conversely, someone might say, oh, I'm going to have a really high fat meal, lots of saturated fat, not much fiber, et cetera, to flatten my glucose, to lower my glucose. That marginally, maybe, but probably could also contribute to insulin resistance. So you're engaging in a behavior to treat a symptom, and by doing so, actually making the underlying pathophysiology worse.
Great. All right. That's really okay. So I'm glad you've gone there. So I think we've basically explained the spikes and what's going on under the hood, et cetera, enough. And yeah, I wanted to then start thinking about effects of diet and exercise. So we've already had Jonathan on talking about keto diets and, the pros and cons of them. If you're a person with diabetes, for example, if you're overweight versus a person that's exercising. And I guess, is it fair enough? Why don't you just do a very quick summary, Jonathan, if you're going to do like a 1 minute summary of your talk, and people can go and watch the whole thing, and then maybe we'll expand on that. How does that sound?
Okay.
2 minutes.
So
Okay.
if you have type 2 diabetes and or glucose intolerance, pre-diabetes, then lowering your refined or total carbohydrate intake probably will help improve your blood sugar control. And that just makes sense. If eating carbohydrates makes blood sugar go up and you consume less of them, then your blood sugar control is likely going to be improved. The issue with food is if you take out one macronutrient, you need to replace it with something else. So what you replace it with probably matters. If you have type 2 diabetes, maybe, Nicola alluded to it, low carbohydrate and a little bit more saturated fat might be a decent trade-off for you. I'll keep my sugars in control and I'll take a little bit of hit on another outcome. So I think that would summarize the previous podcast and my view on that. If you don't have insulin resistance, prediabetes, type 2 diabetes, I don't see evidence nor a reason to follow a keto diet or a low carbohydrate diet in terms of your health or your performance. Now, if you like that or you want to try it, I think you could give it a go, but we don't know the long-term consequences of that. We do know that people tend to not stick to restrictive diets for a very long time. So I always tell people, if I had type 2 diabetes, I would probably follow a low carb or ketogenic diet. Because I don't, I don't think it makes sense for me to follow a very low carbohydrate ketogenic diet now, because I have no idea what's going to happen if I stick to it for 5 years, but I tail off, or 10 years, and then I tail off. I have no idea what's going to happen in that long term. So hopefully that summarizes what we talked about last time, and hopefully my dietitian colleague would agree with me there. I think she probably would, but I'm not sure.
So I'm not going to disagree. I am going to clarify, and I'm sure it was just from brevity that you didn't go further. I mean, first of all, I want to say John makes an excellent point. People talk about what's the best diet, and it really depends on your situation. And I completely agree with John. Like, if you have type 2 diabetes already, and glucose is a serious risk factor for complications of diabetes, it totally makes sense to follow a diet that focuses on lowering glucose. And like John says, if you don't need to worry about glucose, what have you got to gain? And potentially, like I kind of said before about saturated fat, potentially there could be some negative consequences from following such a diet. The thing I just want to clarify about what John said, I don't think there's much evidence, any in fact, that lowering carbohydrate a little bit improves blood glucose levels independent of weight loss, unless this is on two conditions. The first is that you're replacing carbohydrate with quite a bit of protein. That seems to be very effective. Lower your carbohydrate a bit, replace it with a lot of protein. That seems to be excellent at improving glucose, even if you don't lose weight. And the second thing speaks to John's work itself. And that seems to be once you get low enough in carb that you generate ketones, that seems to have an independent effect on, I think, endogenous glucose production. So the amount of glucose that the liver is producing, and that lowers circulating glucose again, even if you don't lose weight. So it's small clarification, but I don't disagree.
Totally agree. And yeah, I think the in disentangling weight loss from carb intake is challenging because typically on a very low carbohydrate diet, people eat less total calories. They tend to lose weight, at least in the short term. So then you can't disentangle, as Nicholas said, lowering of carb from the weight loss independent effect. So I think we are in agreement on that.
You made the point. Oh, sorry.
Can I just in case folks who follow a low carb diet write nasty comments? And people kind of say I'm being too kind of academic when I say independent of weight loss, because like John said, most people, even if they only reduce carbs a bit, do in fact reduce calories and they lose weight. So in practice, we see this in clinical practice a lot. Low carb diets can be fabulous for people with type 2 because they lose weight and you get these reductions in glucose independent of weight loss or with.
Yeah, and Jonathan made the point in his chat the first time that part of the reason people lose weight is they don't have as many options. So they go to eat something, oh, I can't eat that. Oh, I can't eat that. So you just don't eat as much. Okay, so anyway, people can have a look at that one and I'll follow up in the future with that. But yeah, and the other thing, Jonathan, I just wanted to point out is because we have a lot of people that are athletes and things that are interested in this. You made the point that low carb diets aren't the greatest if you want to do sort of high intensity exercise generally. Is that fair to say?
We totally agree. Yes. I don't want to open that can of worms today, I don't think.
No, that's fine. So people can have a look at that. All right. So we've touched on here and there how you could measure your glucose levels. And I touched on for a while there. There's almost this thing out there in Twitter land, et cetera, that elevated increasing your glucose should be avoided at all costs. How do I do that? Buy yourself a continuous glucose monitor, then you can watch it the whole time. So what do we think about that? So maybe if we start with Nicola, who should consider, should people consider looking at their glucose as using a continuous glucose monitor? I guess what even is a continuous glucose monitor? And then who should look at it? Who shouldn't? Who should look at it for a little while and then put it away again, et cetera?
So a continuous glucose monitor basically is a device that can measure your or estimate your blood glucose. And it takes glucose measures about every 5, every 10 minutes, 24 hours a day. You can wear them for 7 to 10 days. So you can kind of get this continuous picture of what your glucose is doing at night, in the morning, lunch, etc. So it could, in theory, provide a great snapshot of what's going on. In terms of who should be using them, let's take a step back and think about what do people want from these devices? Because I think ultimately, I mean, let's mainly stick to cardiovascular disease, just because this is what kills most of us, is cardiovascular risk factors. So depending on the cutoffs and the diagnostic cutoffs that you use, maybe around half the population have a level of blood pressure that is contributing to cardiovascular disease and causing early death. Likewise, maybe a third, 40% have a level of elevated cholesterol. Again, these numbers depend on the population and how you define it, but have a level of cholesterol that is contributing to early death. What about glucose? Type 2 diabetes or diabetes is probably about 10% of the population. So about 10% of the population have, based on the best evidence we have, a reason to be concerned about their glucose. But here's the thing. Even if you take those people who have a level of glucose that we recognize as being a disease, it's recognized as causing damage, glucose isn't necessarily the thing that harms those people. Because like we said before, people with diabetes, they die of stroke, they die of blood pressure. And what we know about drug trials where glucose is reduced. So if you get glucose down to, let's call it a non-diabetic level, in people with diabetes, that doesn't necessarily prevent cardiovascular disease. It doesn't necessarily prevent these complications from occurring or hard endpoints from cardiovascular disease. And that is so crucial to getting at this point, is glucose, even in diabetes, doesn't matter as much as people think it is. So then we move to people, again, you know, we'll call normal glycemia like a hemoglobin A1C of less than 5.7. I mean, I think there's a gray area there, but we understand it to be less than 5.7. In most of those people, they would be, in my view, they should be more concerned about their blood pressure and their cholesterol based on the evidence we have about that contributing to early death. So then what about CGMs? What are you going to do with a CGM? If it gives you this glucose-centric approach to diet, so you're thinking, oh, you know, get this constant reminder, oh, your glucose is going up, it's going up. What do you do about it? And this is a big unknown. But what I see lots of people doing is they cut out fruits, they cut out foods that have, you know, potassium and goodness, things that lower blood pressure. So you're cutting out foods that could be very helpful with regard to a genuine risk factor. Likewise, I mean, I see a lot of these CGM companies saying, you know, have some, you know, maybe Greek yogurt, not terrible at all. The saturated fat content, you know, in a very small amount, is probably doesn't make a difference. But it's kind of perverse to me that we are worrying about glucose spikes in people with normal glucose homeostasis, so far as we know, and in doing so, potentially discouraging people from actions and behaviors that we know to be healthy. So to summarize, I am not clear right now that CGMs are useful simply if it's about keeping an eye on those glucose spikes. And it's largely because we just simply don't have any evidence that we need to be worried if your A1C is a certain level, how high your glucose is getting. But let me just finish by saying these are new. We don't have data right now. We don't have longitudinal data sets where we know, you know, or we have metrics of these glycemic spikes in hundreds or tens of thousands of people. And then we can look and see, does it contribute to Alzheimer's disease? So if we get that data, I'll change my mind. And I think another potentially important point, I have a colleague who's a GP, and he says, you know what I see, Nicola, when I give people a CGM, even if they don't have diabetes, what they do is they just cut out the crap. They just eat better. It nudges them to eat better. Mm. And that's a testable hypothesis. There is one study, but it's not very big. I don't think it's powered. But we could get data, you know, with a structured program. Does a CGM provide people with these nudges to keep an eye on their portion sizes, to limit processed carbohydrates? I'm open-minded that CGMs could be useful in those people. So that's my long spiel.
Wow, that's really great, because I love doing these podcasts, and partly because I'm learning stuff myself, of course. So yeah, my feeling before we, you know, you can probably tell the way I was kind of asking the question, is that, you know, people with type 2 diabetes, yes, definitely. People with type 1 diabetes, yes, definitely, which we haven't discounted that. But then my feeling was almost everyone, even though I don't feel like everyone should be wearing a continuous glucose monitor, my feeling was almost everyone could get something out of it by, you know, wearing it for a couple of weeks and seeing what happens with diet, with exercise and things like that. And I know you're not necessarily going against that. But the main thing I just picked up there was that as you said, it's a symptom, not the cause. So even with people with type 2 diabetes, the elevated glucose, if they got that perfectly controlled, they've still maybe got the high blood pressure. They've still got the other factors. They may not exercising enough, all these other things, which are probably what they're going to kill them, not their actual exact glucose level. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it comes down to what information do people think they're getting from these devices? And I'm not judging individuals and the public at home who use these devices, but what they're being told is get an insight into your metabolism. But as we've talked about, as John clearly explained, glucose without insulin doesn't tell you much at all.
Exactly.
But what information do you think it's telling us?
Yeah, I love the way that Nicola, I hadn't thought of it exactly that way. But to add to that, you know, if using a CGM and then cutting out all the fruit or carbohydrates that you eat in your diet to keep it distracts you from doing another health behavior like exercise or physical activity, which has a whole bunch of health benefits. You're kind of moving the behavior, focusing on keeping your blood sugars steady through whatever means possible, and not paying attention to your blood pressure, your cholesterol, but also your physical activity or like other behaviors that probably are more important, or we have more evidence for sure that will prolong your life or prolong your healthy life.
Exactly. These are just really, really important points. And I can't help but even remind it, a really good friend came over yesterday and she broke her ankle, like shockingly. And she's all happy with herself. Before she broke her ankle, she was, lean, fit, exercising a lot. She actually broke her ankle in a bike crash. And it's just horrific. She's had 12 operations since then, skin grafts, all sorts of things. She got golden staff in hospital. But anyway, bottom line is she said, I really want to get, lose weight now. My ankle's settling down and things like that. So I'm on a low carb diet. And I didn't even know where to start. Like, and it wasn't appropriate. We're just having a chat, with my wife, myself and her. And so how do we even go around that? Because it's just, I don't know. I think it's last time I was in America, I've been there for a bit. Everything's low carb, all the menu's low carb. How do we, and assuming it's because they're trying not to get these glucose spikes, how do we even respond? Like, what do we say to?
I don't know. Back to, I think, your question, just to clarify maybe, and I think Nicola was saying this, if you have type 1 diabetes, like a CGM is amazing, right?
Yes.
If you have type 2 diabetes, it's probably a good tool. And we're getting more and more evidence that just having a CGM and type 2 diabetes with maybe a little bit of education can help control your blood sugar levels. I think there's emerging evidence that maybe as a screening tool type of in someone with prediabetes, maybe CGM could be useful there. But I think in the normal population or normal glycemic population, looking at it could be interesting. Like, go ahead, it's fun. We have them in the lab. I'll wear a CGM once in a while, right? But it's not going to prevent all my spikes. It's probably not that useful for enhancing health of someone with normal glycemia. So just, I think just to clarify, I don't want the readers or the listeners to think that we're down on CGM. There is some uses for it, but just for a normal glycemic person, I don't think it's.
Any thoughts, Nicola?
I mean, I think it might be sobering to understand that CGMs aren't even without risks in people with diabetes. So if you speak to any clinician that manages patients, particularly with type 1, but also with type 2, because lots of people now increasingly, the NHS, sorry to clarify, provides CGMs now for anyone with type 1. So you get to be able to manage your glucose that way. So that's very, very common now. And increasingly, I think people with type 2 are purchasing these devices. But anxiety is a real clinical issue that people are seeing, even in people with diabetes who use these devices. Just having these constant reminders of being concerned and being, or maybe not concerned, alert. Every meal is kind of a test for some people, or it feels that way. So I think it's important to recognize some people will be really empowered, and it's transformed the lives of many people with diabetes because they no longer have to wait 3 months or a year to go and get an A1C. And it's great to feel, I know what my glucose is doing, I can take action, but it's not without I think anxiety is just the best word for it. And I've had in my private clinical practice, people without diabetes who've used these devices. And actually, apart from, and sadly, elevated cholesterol, that's the one major clinical risk factor I see in using CGMs. But the other is they develop an uncomfortable relationship with food. They stop enjoying food. And very often, because of the issue that we spoke about at the start, this idea that, oh my God, if my glucose ever gets to 7.8 at any point, and as a reminder, that's 140 milligram per deciliter, people think if it gets to that at any point, oh my God, I've got prediabetes. And I started writing about this because I would have people come through my clinic and they would write and say, I've got prediabetes. So I begin the consultation and we talk about prediabetes. And I ask when I do my medical review, what's your A1C? And people have an A1C of 5.1%, which is almost athletic. I mean, just an incredibly healthy A1C. And, oh, okay, what makes you think you've got prediabetes? Oh, well, I've got a CGM and it goes up to 7.8, or it goes up to 8.
Mm.
And it
That's
causes
normal physiology.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And actually, I kind of enjoy those consultations because I get to say, don't worry about it. Mm. Many of them have responded by going very low carb, endeavoring to keep their glucose flat. Like I said, in some but not all, their cholesterol goes up. But
yeah.
most importantly, they're pretty miserable because they've cut out all the foods they like. And
Right.
maybe I can just add one thing that I think really illustrates the concern about people using these devices and hearing bad advice or getting no advice, is that if you go low carbohydrate for even 5 days, if you then have a food with any amount of carbohydrate in it, you get an exaggerated glucose response. So again, I see this. People have got these CGMs, they think they've got prediabetes, they go low carb. And then they think, oh, I really miss lentils. So they'll have a serving of lentils, but guess what? They get this exaggerated response.
Oh,
And
I
then
can't
they
do that again.
Oh, I can't tolerate lentils. And they go round in this vicious cycle of thinking, oh God, I've got prediabetes. And in fact, I mean, let me just emphasize, one of the earliest studies that saw how important carbohydrate intake is to glucose tolerance was in young, lean males and females, I think it was both sexes, 5 days of 20 grams of carbohydrate a day. They gave a glucose tolerance test on the fifth day, and these people came back as pre-diabetic. Going low carb causes this kind of, I would call it physiological insulin resistance. So John can probably go deeper into that if needed. But you get this insulin resistance. So even if people weren't pre-diabetic to begin with, once they go low carb and then they're trying to experiment with foods with the CGM, then they're freaking out because they get this exaggerated response to lentils or a banana. And it's really unfair that they're not getting good guidance about how to use these devices and what the numbers mean.
And again, if people can go to Jonathan's, maybe just respond quickly, Jonathan, but Jonathan talked about a lot about this, how the body just responds to what you give it. If you, you know, if you give it high carb, it gets used to high carb. Give it low carb, it gets used to high low carb. And then you give some carbs, it's going to go, whoa. Did you want to just say a little bit about that, Jonathan?
Yeah, no, it just makes it's almost like metabolic flexibility. If you're metabolically flexible and have good metabolic control, you would become a preferential fat burner after 5 days of a low carb, high fat diet. We probably don't need to get into the potential mechanisms, you know, in your muscle or your beta cell that, but that would be normal. That you likely get back, you know, within a few days to getting that insulin sensitivity, insulin secretion back. But to my point before, we don't know what happens if you follow that for 5 years and then start introducing carbohydrates. It's interesting to hear that, Nicola. So I'm not a clinician, but I have endocrinology colleagues. And again, I apologize, not the right, most inclusive language, but they call them the nervous normals, right? That come into their practice and have worn a CGM. And now they're an endocrinologist specializing in diabetes. And they have someone showing up essentially saying that, I think I have diabetes. Can you treat me? Because, my glucose went up to, you know, 10.4 when I had this meal one day or whatever, right? So again, it's interesting if you want to explore it, but the unintended consequences of pushing this around on everybody or to think that that's the case is misinformed.
Great. All right. So has anyone actually looked to see if continuous glucose monitor use increases eating disorders? Because it sounds like it might.
I don't think the data is out there, right?
Same. Don't think it is.
Well, I guess if we're scientists here, we're not going to guess. But it looks like, if anything, it's having some negative effects in that regard. If some people, I guess it depends on the personality type.
And just to add to that, I think there is some studies that show just giving someone a CGM that it isn't a great weight loss tool or anything like that, right? You need to. If you were going to use it, you need to partner it with some sort of behavior change and education and that sort of thing. So maybe that could be where it could be useful. But I think we don't have the unintended consequences of this are not, we don't have the data yet on that. And it's important to think about.
Yeah. And I really should emphasize, I mean, I have a very biased view in the sense that people come to see me because they've got they've had problems with these devices. And if there are people that have got a CGM and they've done really well, they're not going to come and see me. So I think that's important to recognize that I'm looking at a snapshot from my clinic. But I think, again, it comes down to data and evidence that as people increasingly use these CGMs, we'll be able to see the, you know, the good and the bad that come out of their use.
And it is complicated as well, because it just when Jonathan said about whether you lose weight or not, even if you lose weight, as Nicholas said earlier on, is that necessarily a good thing? Because it depends if you're cutting out. I mean, obviously, generally losing weight is a good thing, but if you're doing it by just cutting out all these fruits and vegetables and things to make sure, you know, you're not getting glucose spikes, then is that a good thing? So I guess a more general thing, sometimes you might think, oh, I'm overweight. If I'm losing weight, who cares what I'm eating? What do we think about that? If someone was saying, I've got a glucose monitor and I'm avoiding all these spikes, so I'm not eating much carbohydrate and I'm actually being really careful what I'm eating and I've lost weight, how do we respond to that? I know it depends on the individual.
I've had a lot of experience of this in my clinic, in that people have lost, for example, 15 kilograms from doing a low carb diet. And they've been told by a doctor, oh, my goodness, you shouldn't do that. And obviously, the great thing is about we having primary care, they get their lipid panel checked and all of that kind of thing. But there is just this anxiety about low carb diet in particular. But my view is, what we know about the impact of 15 kilograms of weight loss in someone with type 2 diabetes, they get the weight loss reduces blood pressure massively, it reduces glucose massively, it reduces inflammation massively. So if you're improving most of your clinical risk factors with weight loss, my view is it doesn't really matter how you did it. Nevertheless, like it does when I see these patients, I'm like, hey, if keto works for you, great. But how about making it as healthy as we can by adding low carb fruits in, by having as many veggies, nuts and seeds and goodness that we know is probably pretty important for vascular function and those kind of things long term.
Yeah, I guess, can we think about low carb? And because there's low carb and there's low carb. So people that are thinking, oh, I want to avoid pasta, and somehow potatoes become the worst thing in history as well. Those are macro sort of carb things. And then other people are like, oh, I don't want to eat lettuce. Or can we just clarify, you know, there's very big differences in the carbohydrate content of foods anyway. So, you know, if you are going low carb, and you know, we've talked about pros and cons of that, cutting out pasta and potato, which to me just scares me because I love all that stuff, is different to, like, you know, not having blueberries and not having, you know, a banana and things like that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, so it comes down to, I mean, the amount. So the predominant contributors to total carbohydrate in most Western diets have been things like potatoes, rice, pasta, breads, and cereals. So that there's the number thing there, but there's also the type of carbohydrate. So carbohydrate is an umbrella term for loads of heterogeneous molecules. Sorry, not molecules, kind of disaccharides and monosaccharides, which all differ in their glycemic impact and also what they do generally to the body. For example, if you have fruit, they tend to have a bit of glucose, some sucrose, some fructose. And kind of the mix of that means the impact they have, even though they have a small amount of carbohydrate, the actual glycemic impact is much smaller. So yes, it's a carbohydrate containing food, but it's the type of mono and disaccharides that don't cause a massive rise in your glucose levels. In addition, they probably have these compounds that we think stop glucose or slow glucose absorption at the level of the gut lumen. So you have quantitative differences because starch provides so much carbohydrate, but there are also qualitative differences in terms of the carbohydrate in fruit and veg is absorbed and metabolized quite differently.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Now we've touched on type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes, but maybe just need to clarify. So I want to just make sure people are clear. People with type 1 diabetes don't have their insulin being secreted properly, so they need to inject insulin. And you know, it's life threatening. If you inject too much insulin, your glucose drops. You can die. If you don't inject enough insulin, your glucose will be elevated. That's not good. So they definitely, there's no argument, they need to be keeping an eye on their glucose, whether they have glucose continuous glucose monitors or doing finger pricks, no arguments there. Type 2 diabetes, I just want to kind of summarize what you were saying. So you touched on hemoglobin A1C. So in case people don't know, like Jonathan mentioned earlier, you know, glucose is sticky. It can stick to things. It can stick to hemoglobin, and you get an idea, you know, about roughly about your last 3 months if your glucose has been well controlled. If you've had a lot of elevated glucose, you know, constantly, you'll have more, you know, higher percentage of your hemoglobin A1C, right? And I think what you were getting at earlier on was that, you know, even a person with type 2 diabetes, is it, there's pros and cons of having continuous glucose monitoring and knowing every meal, everything you do, compared to just every 3 months, say, get your hemoglobin A1C and you can see, oh, I've been doing quite well. Oh, I need to do something. Is that fair to say that you were sort of?
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably is going to come down to the person and what they do with the CGM. So for example, in a person with let's say type 2 diabetes, just to give you an example, we want to keep an eye on blood pressure and cholesterol and glucose at the same time. So if we give them a CGM, but along with the CGM, we emphasize, you don't need to get completely flat, you know, have a lot of fruit and vegetables, and general healthy behaviors that we know, even if people weren't using CGMs, are good. Because the point is, when I think about CGMs in type 2 diabetes, it comes down to me, well, why do we want to gather information unless it's going to change the advice we give or what the patient does? So the advice you would give a patient, so if a patient has overweight or obesity, it would be about trying to help them with weight loss. It would be trying to either use drugs, you know, medications or foods to lower their blood pressure and lower their cholesterol. So my question is, well, what does a CGM add to that? Could it help people consume healthier foods that address all of the three risk factors? And I think the answer is we don't actually know yet. And I think it will probably come down to what a patient gets from it and how useful they find it.
Okay. I think we'll start thinking about exercise a bit more. Any other thoughts on that, Jonathan, before we?
No, maybe it's a good transition in the exercise, though. We've done a study with my wife, Dr. Mary Jung, who's a health behavior psychologist, and where we partnered CGM in a small pilot study in individuals with prediabetes and type 2 diabetes, but then partnered it with behavior change techniques and counseling to say, you know, here's what happened on a day when you did exercise. We can see glucose was lower after the meal. And then that we showed in that study that they had greater adherence over an 8-week exercise program, and their motivation to exercise was higher. So again, very pilot study, small, right. But again, that's where I think it could be useful if it's, you know, partnered with something. Although there would be individual differences, of course, if you give it to some people and they're going to go and figure out on their own, and it may be beneficial for them. But I think that's where I would think it would go. And that's where I think the literature suggests that too. If you can partner it with some education and behavior change, CGM could be very useful in that.
Perfect. So why don't we think, as you touched on there, that, you know, your glucose levels can go down during exercise, et cetera. How about you give a bit of a background on what actually happens to glucose during exercise? And, sure. And maybe we can also think about the acute. So when you, during the actual acute exercise, and yeah, then maybe the, you know, the next couple of days as well.
Sure. So maybe we'll start with all we've been talking about, and what a CGM is measures is glucose concentration, right? Mm-hmm. That's not glucose flux. So glucose concentration that we measure, we've talked about 7 millimoles or whatever, is a balance of what's coming into the system and what's going out of the system. So what brings glucose in? Your liver, as I mentioned, is always leaking or trickling glucose into the system, into the blood, and then what you eat and digest and absorb. So you have two kind of variables coming in, and then the variable going out is, we always think of, and we're talking about exercise, muscle is sucking up glucose. So it's going to be the balance of what's coming in and what's coming out. So you start the exercise, we probably all know this, and it makes intuitive sense. Your muscle needs some energy, so your muscle starts sucking up more glucose. Well, the same thing when you start exercising, there's some hormones released, stress hormones, catecholamines, which primarily tell your liver to start producing extra glucose. And usually it's a pretty good balance. So you don't see much of a change in your blood glucose concentration during exercise, although the flux is higher, mm-hmm, right? Where things get, you know, tricky or different is that all depends on who you are, your underlying physiology, when you've eaten and what you've eaten, because that brings another variable into the situation, and then the intensity of exercise. So I'll let you take it from there. But that's what's
Yes.
going on during exercise. So things
Oh,
are fluctuating and there's
beautiful,
content.
Beautifully explained. And it's the same with people think about lactate threshold and my lactates went up, that's my anaerobic threshold. No, when you're exercising at a low intensity, you have more lactate production, more lactate clearance. It's only when it starts to accumulate. Same thing with exercise. So as you see, you start exercise, you might have a 10, 20 fold increase in your glucose uptake by the muscle, but you're actually releasing more glucose as well. So the glucose concentration doesn't change. It doesn't mean nothing's going on. Okay. And then what about if we, because we've touched on, and we'll talk about the effects of different intensities, but we've touched on insulin sensitivity. So what effect does that? So you do your acute exercise, the glucose levels may change, may not. You know, if you go long enough, they'll start to drop, and then you might think about eating or drinking carbohydrate. But just say you've done an hour of exercise, your glucose levels haven't really changed that much because they can be maintained for about an hour generally. What happens for the next couple of days to your insulin sensitivity?
Yeah. So, you know, for the next 24 hours, maybe up to 48 hours, your insulin sensitivity is improved, which means, or should mean, I guess, when you have a meal in the next 24 hours, you either get less of a glucose spike, or to tie things together, you might get the same glucose spike, but it costs you less insulin to clear that glucose. So I would say definitely in individuals living with type 2 diabetes, in our work, we'll control diet and have them exercise day or not exercise day. And we can clearly see, or usually clearly see, depending on the exercise intensity, duration, that sort of thing, they'll have less glucose spikes after those meals, which is likely indicative of improved insulin sensitivity. Individuals living with overweight and obesity, we've shown that too for up to about 24 hours. So you exercise today and then tomorrow's breakfast, we get less of a spike, suggesting that insulin sensitivity is improved. When you get to normal glycemic individuals, I don't think we see much of I don't think there's evidence in the literature. I've actually never done a published research study on this, but even in the literature, the insulin sensitizing effects of exercise will be there in someone who's normal glycemic, but whether you see it on a CGM, I'm not sure you will, because it's just a regression to the mean, or there's not enough room that if you're so well controlled to see an effect. If you do a hyperinsulinemic euglycemic clamp, yes, you can see it. If you give a regular meal for lunch or dinner, you may or may not see that in someone who's normal glycemic. Does that help?
It does have a lot. Any thoughts, Nicola? Any clarification, Jabby, all that?
I think this area is one of those things, again, it kind of relates to this growing use of CGMs. And I think maybe at the end, we're going to talk about bugbears that we have. And one of them is this idea that influencers are selling, to be honest, which is that CGMs can be great because you can identify which foods that you can't tolerate. Whereas, as John has explained, and what the literature shows is, depending on the type of exercise you do, its intensity, the effect on your glucose tolerance or insulin resistance, or whatever, you know, however we describe it, means that the banana you have before your exercise is going to have a different glucose response to eating the same banana in the immediate post-exercise period, and potentially versus eating that same banana the next day. So because these, you know, the underlying stuff is changing, the symptom that you get from it then responds. And what people interpret from that is, if they have a banana in this kind of insulin resistance phase following exercise, it makes them look like it's shooting up. Whereas actually it's not the banana, it's what's going on underneath.
Exactly. All right. And the interesting thing, and again, to tie it in, because the exercise has sort of just shifted things, but it hasn't changed the physiology. So again, you have a spike if you've got normal glucose tolerance, normal insulin sensitivity, et cetera, and you have a spike, you know, you do your exercise and you have your banana and you get a spike, that's not anything to worry about. But if you've got this underlying elevated glucose and you have a spike and it's less, well, great, right? And if the actual underlying, you know, under the bonnet, the glucose is down a little bit because you've exercised, that's great. And if you get less of a spike, that's great. But again, it's the underlying, you know, it's the almost the set point that's the main thing. Is that fair to say? It's not the spike so much.
Yeah, I think I would summarize it by saying, as we've emphasized, I think throughout, glucose is a symptom, and in isolation doesn't tell you that much.
Exactly right. So we've talked about just, you know, normal exercise, you know, submax exercise, for example, your glucose doesn't really change. The rate of appearance and the rate of disappearance is pretty equal. If you go long enough, it'll start to drop, et cetera, but let's not get into all that. But what about if you do, you know, and talk about these glucose spikes again. So what about if you do really high intensity exercise? What happens then?
Yeah. So if we think back to what I just mentioned about fluxes, and this is comes down to classic work actually done in Canada at U of T by Marlis and Vranek. Showing that in intense exercise, you can sometimes overshoot that flux. So the liver will produce too much or extra than the muscle can take up. So you actually get an increase in glucose during an intense or a maximal bout of exercise. If you look at the published studies, which I think are the best from Marlis and Vranek, that amount would go from 5 millimoles in a healthy person to 7 or 8 millimoles at the end of maybe 10 minutes of all-out exercise. So it's not a crazy spike. There's one or two older papers that suggest it maybe goes up to, you know, above 10. I think Philip Larson has work or, you know, published data and unpublished data in elite athletes training hard that they say they can see 10 millimoles and above. With intense exercise. So, and there may be some evidence that athletes have a greater response there. I think it's normal physiology that the liver's just, you know, responding to the catecholamine rush and producing more glucose than the muscle can take up. And then we see, and then those studies, again, from the best studies with glucose tracers and repeat blood samples every 5 minutes, they show that you then produce some insulin and it comes back down within 30 minutes after a bout of exercise. So probably more to be done there in terms of, you know, elite athletes training hard and different types of training combined with nutrition, because we've never had continuous glucose monitors to look at this every minute of every single day, right? So it's probably been happening for as long as people have been exercising intensely and training. We just now pick it up because you have a CGM. But if you go to the literature, it's there. I think it's just a normal physiological response.
Exactly.
I think that's a great point, John, because I see in my practice athletes, and you make such a good point that we've never seen this before because we've never had CGMs, and just reassuring people, it's normal. And I think when you look at the literature on the kind of exercise and when glucose rises and by how much, I mean, the 2 to 3 millimole per liter you described is actually quite a lot. I mean, that's, I think to put it in milligram per deciliter, you're sort of talking from going to from 90, maybe up to about 150. So it's not a small rise. And what I do is I just reassure athletes, particularly people doing tons and tons of endurance exercise, expect your glucose to do crazy stuff. And I think if we get more data, we can be more precise than that. But I just reassure them that this kind of stuff happens. It's normal. Don't worry about it.
It's totally normal. It happens in everyone. It happens in people with type 1 diabetes as well. And I guess people could look at Michael Riddell's chat that I had with him about that, you know, what should they do about their insulin? But yeah, it's totally normal. And I don't know if we actually know the reason, but the feeling I always thought was, you do the hard exercise, you want to resynthesize your glycogen. So it's actually a good thing to have this, you know, this big catecholamine, so adrenaline rush. Glucose is pumped out of the liver fast and the muscle takes it up. The glucose is elevated and then the muscle can take it up, right? So it's almost like a good design. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on it.
Yeah, I would say also it probably makes sense. You if you're running away from the lion or whatever, it's better to overshoot and have a little bit of extra for your muscles to be able to use than to have too little. It's probably more complex than that, but it kind of makes sense to me that the pressure would be that way as opposed to the other way.
Exactly. And a similar thing, which is when you do acute exercise and then you have, if you do an oral glucose tolerance test, for example, after acute exercise, you actually see a greater increase in glucose than normal. So people think that's a bad thing.
That's the point I made about the banana. If you're having the same glucose exposure at different points, you're going to get a different response. And like I said, nothing to do with the banana. It's what's happening underneath.
Exactly. So the good, in a way, that again sort of makes sense because you do exercise, then you have the banana, you actually get a greater glucose response than if you hadn't. But again, it looks like it's because the liver actually lets more of that glucose through so that the muscle then gets it. So, yeah, so it means, yeah, there's actually a greater rate of a glucose appearance after the exercise. So it doesn't mean you've got a problem with your glucose tolerance. The body's actually purposely letting it go through so that I think so the muscle can get it. Okay, now I know Jonathan's tight on time. Do you have to go or?
I do need to go in, let's say, 2 to 3 minutes, but I guess you've never had two people. I could leave and Nicola could stay on to answer any final questions.
Yeah, we haven't had any Twitter questions or anything yet. That's the only thing. So one thing I've liked doing, because a large part of the reason I do inside exercise is I want people to get their information from the experts rather than from influencers. So I like to ask people, do they have any pet peeves around this area? Nicola?
Happy to start, yes. I really sympathize with the public because I think it is incredibly difficult now to identify who actually knows what they're talking about. And there are so many MDs out there. Are you a name podcast or shall I just not
you
name
can.
Names?
I'm happy for you to.
I mean, Peter Attia is a big one. None of these people have ever, to my knowledge, been a principal investigator, co-investigator on any study. I don't think they have substantive experience in any of the things they're talking about. And kind of as a person who understands the glucose literature, I can see just how utterly misguided at best their interpretation of the literature is. So just to give you an example, because I have a patient who reads Peter Attia's blog, he describes this study, and it was done in people without diabetes, on, you know, oscillating glucose, and it showed you get greater oxidative stress. And Peter describes this, because it's done in people without diabetes, as, oh, you know, oscillating glucose matters in healthy people. If you look at the method, what they did is gave people 5 millimole per liter or 15 millimole per liter. So that's 90 to 270 milligram per deciliter. But they went up to 270 milligram per deciliter for 6 hours.
Yes.
And then back to, that's got nothing to do with the glucose spike. No. If you think 6 hours of something is comparable to 15 minutes, you'd advise people to never go in a sauna. Because if you go in one for 6 hours, you'd probably end up in a coma. You know what I mean?
Perfect.
It's a perfect example, isn't it? It's ludicrous to think that these transient glucose increases probably go to 11 have anything to do. And it's just this wild misinterpretation of a paper that was done to try to understand what the hyperglycemia in diabetes does to vascular function. And then you get this questionable character, this content creator that is telling his audience, guys, this is why you need a CGM. So that's my pet peeve.
Well, you know, it fits perfectly with, I was thinking a couple of times when we've been talking, people with high blood pressure, they have high blood pressure, but when they exercise, it goes higher. Oh, therefore don't do it. No, exercise is good for high blood pressure. Jonathan, what pet peeve do you have?
Yeah, maybe in this space, it would be, you know, calling 7.8 millimole or 126 mg per deciliter pre-diabetes glucose levels. Oftentimes people use the wrong, they don't use person first language too, so they would say pre-diabetic, you say pre-diabetes, but they'll say pre-diabetes glucose levels, you know, and we want to avoid that. And again, it's a misconception. Pre-diabetes glucose levels are 2 hours after having 75 grams of glucose in the morning after an overnight fast. So 7.8 millimolar 30 minutes after consuming a bagel is not
that's
pre-diabetes. It's normal
physiology. And if you didn't have that, there'd be something wrong. Okay, Jonathan, I know you've got to race off, but what I like to do is take away messages at the end. So maybe Nicola can do that and you can race off. Okay. Thank you very much for coming on, Jonathan.
I think we're on the same page. And this was fun to be here again and great to be on with you, Nicola. Thank you very much.
Thank you, mate.
Nice
see you. Bye-bye. Okay, so I wonder if we could finish up with some takeaway messages, Nicola.
I mean, I think John's point there really highlights the thing that we've been talking about. What we know is that if your glucose is constantly elevated, if your tissues are exposed to chronically elevated glucose, this is what pre-diabetes is. This is what diabetes is. This is how they're defined and what determines the negative health consequences. When we're talking about these brief glucose spikes, as far as we know right now, it's normal physiology. And I'll maintain that view until we have evidence that suggests otherwise.
Perfect. All right. And wonder if I, just while I've got you, and I know it's a can of worms, but how do you respond to my friend saying, oh, I put on weight? I need to, I've got to go low carb.
If a patient comes to see me and they're eager for weight loss and they want to talk about how to do it, it's all about finding the right diet for them. So, for example, if someone isn't that into starches, if they're not big into bread and they're not big into potatoes, low carb can be a great diet because you can have fish, you can have vegetarian alternatives to meat, you can have meat, can have eggs, ton of veggies, some healthy fat. It can be really filling, really satisfying, and it's something they can stick to. And if that helps them lose weight, fantastic. But if someone, for example, comes from a culture where kind of, breaking bread and sharing food and typically high starch diets, that's going to be really tough to stick to because we respond to social cues and all of those kind of things. So there is never one right diet for everyone. I've seen low carb work brilliantly for many, many patients who've struggled with every other kind of diet. So very happy to endorse low carb as something that works. That doesn't mean that some of the exaggerated claims about low carb diets that we hear are necessarily true.
That's true. And then one other thing I just wanted to bring out. So you know how you said as long as you're losing weight, that's great. But again, obviously long term. So sorry, it depends how long you keep doing this. So yesterday I saw there's a show on here, and it was talking about cereals, people using cereals as a snack. And they were talking about, I don't know if you have Special K. It's
Yeah.
a yeah. So they're talking about how special when Special K came out, they made this big deal about if you have Special K. For breakfast and Special K for dinner, and that's it. You will lose weight. And sure, they did because that's all they had, Special K for breakfast, Special K for dinner. But I'm assuming you wouldn't suggest people do that forever because what about all the other nutrients? So even though generally we say losing weight is a good thing, you still need to get the nutrients. So bringing in what you said earlier about let's not miss out on all these great nutrients.
Yeah, I mean, I think typically, let's for example talk about very low energy diets. This is a formula-based diet where people are basically having shakes and soups. You only need to follow that for about 8 to 12 weeks, and you can get to about 10 to 15 kilogram weight loss, which about is close to the maximum that we see on average in most diets. So they do really well. The key is what you do long term. So I actually am not that concerned generally about what people do if they want to lose weight really quick, how they do it. Protein's probably very important because you're only doing that for 8 weeks. So you don't become vitamin, you could possibly become slightly deficient in some, but like things like fat soluble vitamins, you would get, and many of these products do have vitamins and minerals anyway. But even if they were doing it with the old school milk diet, that used to be a thing. People used to have milk for 8 weeks. Sometimes they'd be recommended a vitamin tablet, sometimes not. It's only 8 weeks.
True.
And then you think about nutrition afterwards. So in an ideal world, you'd want, a nutritious multivitamin complete diet for 8 to 12 weeks. But I wouldn't ever be,
You're right.
I'm never
Exactly.
largely concerned about nutritional quality for very short periods.
That's true. Because it reminds me of, I don't know if it's true or not, but I saw someone who's got the world record for the longest time fasting. So the guy who's massively overweight, and then he didn't eat for like 6 months or something and just drank water. And he didn't die of, vitamin deficiencies. I'm not suggesting people do it, but that's just taking it to the nth degree. Now, I know, again, I'm kind of, while I've got you, I just know that you texted me and said, I said, one of the things I said is what's something you're working on that you're excited about? And you said amino acid stimulated insulin secretion. Would you like to have the opportunity to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's something that I wish people knew more about, and I wish there was more work on. So this is when people develop type 2 diabetes, their beta cells become less sensitive to changes in glucose. So basically, the beta cell has a sensor on it. In healthy people, as your glucose goes up, the sensor goes, "Oh my gosh, glucose is going up. Hey, we've got to produce insulin." That sensor becomes less sensitive in type 2 diabetes. So what happens is they'll have a meal, they'll have some toast, their glucose will go up, but their sensor doesn't recognize it. So the beta cells aren't as responsive as producing insulin. But the really interesting thing is, as far as we know, the beta cells remain sensitive to changes in amino acid concentration in the blood. So if the amino acid concentration goes up, beta cells go, "Well, we've got to produce insulin." And so this is probably the reason the high protein diets work really well. So I talked about, yeah, low carb probably doesn't do much. But if you combine low carb with high protein, it's probably this insulinogenic amino acids that are causing a good insulin response. Boom, it brings glucose right back down. But the thing I find really interesting, I recently wrote a paper with Jim Johnson and team from UBC in Canada, looking at individual amino acids, because the different amino acids, they work via distinct pathways in the beta cell. And there are probably some amino acids which are particularly insulinogenic. And because they work via different pathways, they probably can work in quite a complementary fashion. So I think there's work to be done, and Jim and I are going to be working on this, to try to find an optimal mix of amino acids that you could have maybe in a supplement or however it might work, to stimulate insulin release and lower glucose. And the most, to me, exciting part of this in terms of therapeutic potential of high protein diets or just mixtures of amino acids is long-standing type 2 diabetes. Because people with type 2 diabetes who've had it for like 6 years or more are much less likely to get remission, even with marked weight loss, because their beta cells simply don't come back. They don't respond to glucose again. I think, and we think, they respond to amino acids. So we think we can personalize interventions for long-standing type 2, possibly get people off their insulin with using these mixtures of amino acids.
Okay, well, this is interesting, and I can't let you go because I've had Luke Van Loon on.
I love Luke. Oh, he's a legend. Oh, yeah, I love Luke Van Loon's work. It's phenomenal researcher.
Yeah, so people can look at that. And I've had Stu Phillips on, and they're both saying you don't really need these high carb. You know, people are obsessed with protein. You know, go to the gym and they're just eating kilograms of chicken every millisecond, and then protein powders straight after, and all sorts of things. They were basically saying you generally get enough protein from your diet, most people, and especially if you're exercising, you get enough protein. I'm wondering what you think about that, because I just want to have see if there's continuity of message.
Yeah, I mean,
and then diabetics are obviously different, I guess.
Oh, for sure. So I mean, I think I've seen Stu write about this on Twitter, where I used to get all my information before I left it. And I think he would acknowledge, I think you need probably around like 1.3 to maybe, I think, maxing out at 2.2 grams of protein per kilogram body weight.
Probably a bit lower than that, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Big range. I mean, I don't know this data intimately. I would argue, so I weight train, I do lots of running, I need a lot of protein, but my calorie requirements aren't that high. So I would argue for some people, actually, the supplements can be useful because they can just be a way of getting to your target. But yes, I would certainly agree that there comes to a point, and I don't know exactly where it is, I'm sure you do, where getting more protein in doesn't do anything because you just oxidize it.
Yeah, and are you a fan of food first? I'm assuming you are, based on the chat we've had. Rather than supplements?
I mean, it really depends on the person. I mean, food ideally for enjoyment, for the extra nutrients that you get in food. But personally, protein, I would really struggle to get to my protein requirement without protein powders.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. So I do encourage people, because as I said earlier, I'm not a big fan of supplements. I do encourage people to listen to Stu Phillips and Luke Van Loon's to see what they say about that. And one thing I wanted to say, I've been trying to get Bente Keens on. So I've just been in Copenhagen for 6 months doing research from Copenhagen. She's actually been doing research on lower approach to doing more like 0.8 grams per kilogram, and finding that people can actually sometimes exercise better because, you know, you said how Jonathan said earlier, when you increase one macronutrient, you're taking away from another. So she's finding that people that have high protein diets tend to have lower carbohydrate and they don't perform as well. So there's more to be said in the space. But I'm trying to get her on, but I haven't had any luck yet. So I guess I'm not trying to take away from anything you said there, but it's, what am I saying? Have a look at Stu's and Luke Van Loon's chats about the protein needs, and then think about whether you need to supplement or not, and then supplement that knowledge with what Nicola just said. Is that fair to say?
I thought, so Luke Van Loon has some great papers in people with type 2 where he gives them added protein. I think he might have added leucine in as well, and it goes back to this insulin response. And I'm not a physiologist, and this isn't my area, but I think the point he was making is that in type 2 diabetes, particularly older individuals, they maybe don't get enough of an anabolic response to increase muscle protein synthesis. And then those people, maybe it's the insulin helping the amino acids into the muscle. I mean, you
yeah, the anabolic resistance stuff. Yeah, and how exercise can improve
and
that.
I think Luke Van Loon's point was in people with type 2 diabetes, actually, again, because of the insulinogenic effects of amino acids, that can be useful for muscle protein synthesis in people with type 2 diabetes because they don't produce as much insulin without amino acids.
So people can have a look at that. That's great. Now, I just realized we've already done takeaway messages, and then we talk some more. And I just can't let you go. And it's kind of weird because Jonathan's gone. But anyway, I'm having fun. So hopefully people are having fun listening. Can we just finish up? So the last takeaway message, should everyone, and we kind of already know the answer, but in case people jumped straight to the takeaway messages, can everyone benefit from having a continuous glucose monitor?
I feel like I'm making a judgment there that is speaking for people. And I think it's really important for individuals to have the freedom to use things as they see fit. I guess I would clarify and say my concern is that CGM companies and nutrition companies who promote the use of CGM are being very dishonest, or either they don't have the knowledge to tell this, that CGMs in people without diabetes actually don't tell you much at all. And as we emphasize throughout this podcast, glucose on its own doesn't tell you much at all. It's a symptom of what's going on underneath in terms of the glucose spikes.
So to be a bit of a devil's advocate, or not a devil's advocate, just thinking beyond that, what if they had a continuous glucose monitor that continually measured insulin?
Again, I think you'd want to do it with glucose. And again, it would go back to the comments I made, you know, what kills people?
Exactly.
It's, in terms of the most people that are affected by cardiovascular risk factors, it's blood pressure and lipids. And then let's not forget, life's supposed to be fun. I can't fathom the mental energy that people might be putting into measuring their glucose every 5 minutes, their insulin every 10 minutes, because if we get one of those devices, you know, recording their adiponectin, taping lipid panels every week, it's like, man, just eat as healthy as you can, exercise, keep a healthy weight. For most people, doing the job.
Things get too complicated. So we've often said on here, when we say, oh, what's the best exercise to do? It's like, well, just go out and exercise. The main problem is we don't have enough people exercising. It's the same. If they're doing all those things you said and counting calories and who knows what else, and then also going, hang on, should I do high intensity exercise, low intensity exercise? You know, it just gets too complicated. You know, how long do I go for? Do I have a carbohydrate drink during it or not? Do I need to be hydrated before, during, after? It just gets too complicated. Just go out there and do it.
Yeah. I think once you get to a certain level of exercise, if you're a healthy weight, your diet's pretty much okay. Beyond that, as much as people don't want to hear it, lots of things don't make any difference at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't have evidence they do. So just relax and chill out. And I think it's really sad to me that people might be paying attention to things that they absolutely don't need to worry about. Pay attention to people, pay attention to your partner, your friends, rather than measuring your glucose every 5 minutes, hoping it's going to, you know, tell you the meaning of life.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time, your extra time. And it was great having Jonathan on as well. And I'll see you next time. I'll see you around or something. Okay. Good on you.
Thanks
see you.
So much, Glenn.
Bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.